Hi, this is Galen of NetSurfer Pro. I just wanted to say here at the beginning, we try to keep this show pretty lighthearted, pretty no bummers, but unfortunately right now the world is pretty scary. So just wanted to say, if you want to do anything, if you feel like you need to take some kind of action, we ask that you donate to the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund, the PCRF. I myself have donated, and it's a good way to actually help out. Even, a small amount, even the littlest bit that you can spare will help immensely. So thank you very much and enjoy the show.
I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web.
Computer today.
Computer.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
Alright, we made it out of Spooky Month. We made it out of Housetober.
We finally got out of the house.
Yeah, I know. It took so long.
Yeah.
It was almost like boat levels. Honestly,
true.
If there was a houseboat, we would be fucked.
Oh god, yeah. Honestly, the hardest part about getting out of the house is that you have to touch grass afterwards, and I've literally never touched grass in my life.
I know, you kind of float over it. It's really impressive, honestly. Do you have, like, bee wings or something?
I don't have bee wings. It's more that I have this power where I can only float a few inches off the ground. Unless I say my name backwards minus the first letter.
Okay. I'm not gonna make you do that.
Okay, good.
Unless it would give me a free lunch special.
We'll see.
We'll see.
But, hey, thank you very much for listening to Talk Surfer Show, a whirlwind ride through whatever we want. I'm your main host this week, Galen.
And I'm your co-host this week, Matthew Marissa.
And we're just here to talk about some stuff, and surf about some stuff.
We do know surfing, by the way.
Yeah.
I've never touched water in my life. I actually float above water.
Nice.
That's my power.
Yeah.
It's a step above Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, Jesus could walk on water, but could he float on water?
Sorry, I'm hydrophobic.
Yeah,
so
I just hate water so much.
Speaking of hating water, what are your thoughts on water levels?
Especially in
2D platformers.
Oh, 2D platformer water levels? Well, notoriously, they are all terrible, and not a single game has ever done it well. In fact, I don't think there's ever been a good 2D platformer ever, especially not recently. Oh, wait.
You're forgetting about Ukulele Impossible Layer. Come on.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, of course.
But there is a good number two.
Yes, there's a pretty decent contender right now for, the queen spot here on 2D platformers, and that is Super Mario Wonder!
Wonder when those flowers are gonna shut up. No, this is sort of a state of the meme, because I've seen so many people making, like, memes of these talking flowers.
Yes.
So Super Mario Wonder, new Mario game. It's great. There's a lot of cool, weird, interesting ideas. But we need to talk about the talking flowers.
Yeah.
This is, like, one of the highlights of the game. One of the things they showed off super early.
Yeah.
You're in the Flower Kingdom, which means caterpillar people, but also flower people. And also, like, these, like, they look like yellow fire flowers, but almost like a trumpet horn.
Yeah.
Where you can see into their throats. It is a :0 face.
Yeah. That's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. They got the like, oh god, what's the, there was like a show or something that had that style that I'm trying to remember. Oh man.
Nanalan?
That's good. You know, I'm going to say yes to
AKA
that.
AKA Nanalan?
A.K.A. Banana Man.
A.K.A. the smiley singing Boulevard of Broken Dreams.
Yeah. But yeah, Super Mario Wonder's flowers have kind of taken the internet by storm a bit.
I love it because, like, they're kind of annoying. Sometimes they're just, like, weird freaks. And the internet has really latched on to the weird freaks bit.
Yup.
I've seen a lot of, like, speech bubble replacements, but with them saying, like, you know, what if there were two guys on the moon and one of them killed the other with a rock? Wouldn't that be kind of fucked up?
I like the animation somebody made of the, like, if your leg got cut off, how would it hurt?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, it's something where, like, on one hand, I understand people who are annoyed by it, and I know, I believe they have the option to shut them up, but my god, they have so much personality.
They're, like, omnipresent, and they have no range of emotion visually. All their emotion is through their mouth and their face, and their voice, I mean, but, like, it also, the way they react to things is, like, weirdly nonchalant at times.
Yeah.
It's like they're always stressed, but not stressed enough to snap. Just, like, slightly stressed.
They're like Peridot.
Yeah. I wish they were like Peridot. No, they're great. They're like, I don't know how to put it, but they're so weird and different from anything in Mario. Because, like, you don't really see people talk in Mario games, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah, we famously, of course, we got a new voice for Mario and I believe Luigi. I believe
Charles Martinet. Everything Charles Martinet did, which was Mario, Luigi, Wario, Waluigi.
Yeah, I feel like he should still be voicing Waluigi. I know he's not going to, but God damn it. He's retired.
Let the man have peace.
The man can have peace, but he needs to be Wario. No one can replace him as Wario. Anyway, yeah, we do have the new Mario and Wario Brothers voices, of course. But, like, it's interesting that, like, in addition to that, we also now have just, like, the most, like you said, the most talking in any fucking Mario game. It's
the tiny mascot character that travels with the main heroes and, like, gives commentary. It's the pig from Seven Deadly Sins.
Yeah, it's the
like, he could wear a scouter if he wanted, and it wouldn't be out of place. Talk about power levels. Uh-oh, this one's a little too hard for you now, Mario.
And then you get to impress him by being an elite gamer.
Did you just do a cool gamer move?
Wow, you just did what's known as a pro gamer move.
Yeah. A few highlights for the actual gameplay. So for reference, I am in the desert world, which is one of the fourth worlds, which is to say, so you go through three worlds, and then after the third one, you get to choose which of the next three you do next.
Yep. I believe New Super Mario Brothers did the same thing, or one of them did a similar thing.
No.
Was it 3D Land that did it? There was one of them that had a very similar thing. But, point being...
Yeah, so point being, you're thinking of Shrek Party.
Oh! Of course, I'm often thinking about Shrek Party.
So, I think what's worth noting is that this was made by a separate studio than the normal Mario games. It still has a lot of the New Soup or New Super Mario Brothers sort of energy. Like, it has twirling.
Yep.
But at the same time, it has a lot of unique character and charm. The most obvious are the Wonder Flowers, which change the level that you play in, which can have a variety of effects. Sometimes it creates like a weird auto-scroller. Sometimes it changes the properties of you. Like, there's one that makes you tall.
Yep.
And when you duck, the scenery ducks.
There's one where instead of walking on the 2D plane, you end up like walking as though it's like an isometric, like
a top-down view.
Yeah. It's like Ultima.
Or Zelda.
Or Ultima.
Yeah, you walk on the wall, essentially. There's some that, like, weirdly modify the level, like one that tilts the level so that everything's at an angle. It's really clever. It genuinely feels like I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
This is still in line with the design philosophy of Mario, which has always been about giving each level sort of an identity. But I think it just takes it to another step in this one.
Yeah. I've had this sort of lowercase t theory, I'll say, this hypothesis for a little while of, like, the eras of Nintendo, that, like, there's slightly defined eras. For example, like, the GameCube era is what I like to call fun Nintendo.
It's where, like, experimental Nintendo.
Yeah, it's like a lot of things were very wacky, a lot of things were very non-standard to how they, you know, eventually would be. That's when you got Wind Waker, Sunshine, etc., etc., all the Mario Sports games and their, like, wacky different takes on it. Then in, like, Wii, you had, like, casual Nintendo. I use that term neutrally. It's not necessarily a bad thing. But, like, you know, you had a lot of games that were directly more targeted towards, like, a broader audience. You did still have a lot of the, like, you know, high concept stuff of, like, Twilight Princess, what have you, Metroid Prime.
I feel like Wii was, like, wide Nintendo.
Yeah.
They were both trying to appear to the most casual crowd, which is Grandpa.
Yeah.
But then they also were kind of trying to work in more mature things, which I feel like that's when they really started publishing more mature things. Remember Red Steel?
God, yeah. Red Steel needs to make a comeback.
Does it?
Probably not. Cold Steel, though. Cold Steel needs to.
Yeah.
And then, like, I would say that the previous era we were in is Prestige Nintendo. This is, like, Wii U to, like, early Switch of, like, Nintendo essentially trying to be, like, we're still here and we're a massive player.
They kind of rested on their laurels.
Yeah.
For better or worse, I think, like, Switch had a lot of good experimentation, and it gave us things like ARMS, which are, like, interesting bits. I think ARMS was decent. I don't need to get into it right now, but, like, It is also worth noting, though, that a lot... Well, I guess, like, Breath of the Wild was a huge departure.
Yeah. Breath of the Wild was a massive departure. Odyssey was a big departure in how it sort of returned to form.
Maybe.
I don't know if I would say it was a massive departure, but it was sort of like a refining of so much of Mario, 3D Mario specifically, up until that point.
Yeah.
But it seems like we are getting back to a mix of like GameCube and Switch era with some of the stuff that they've been doing and some of the stuff that they've been releasing. And Mario Wonder, I really, really hope, shows Nintendo that yes, oh my god, yes, we want fun Nintendo again.
Yeah, there's been this weird thing where like, there have been a lot of experiments on the hardware side of Switch, and there's things like Labo that feel like fresh, new ideas that didn't really pan out as like a financial model.
Yeah.
They were well received in the moment, but I don't think in history they're going to necessarily be like a major turning point. But like at the same time, there's been a lot of just safe Nintendo stuff, like how kind of minimal the sports games and spinoffs have been.
Yeah, God, yeah.
And I think one thing about that is that Mario had sort of a standard or like a set of standards, it felt like.
Yeah.
The way I use it is like Charging Chuck became a really prominent enemy because like they were brought back in 3D World on the Wii U. But then like all the spinoffs after that use Charging Chuck, and I feel like that is emblematic of like they're not trying to add new enemies too much to Mario or new characters. Odyssey kind of broke the seal on that, but really only in the form of like the NPCs and not the enemies specifically.
Yeah, there were
the Brutals, but yeah,
there were the Brutals, there were the Gushin,
yeah, the Blowies. But like Wonder, it has so many enemies that are unique to Wonder. And I think that's really nice.
Yeah.
There's like the weird shell hoppy dudes. Those are great. You play as one. It's really cool. I also feel like as far as this era of Nintendo goes, like there's always been Switch 2 rumors, even a year after Switch 1.
Yeah.
But like, I feel like we might be in the point where they are kind of letting other studios make games, or at least like experimenting with their own series, because they're gearing to do their next console. And like, if this is on sort of the sunset phase,
yeah,
then it's fine to sort of flex a little bit. Nintendo made a shit ton of money off the Switch. Like, the Switch was successful enough that I think they have room to experiment.
Yeah.
And I feel like they've made up their losses from the Wii U now, which is why we're seeing this.
Yes.
Like, the Wii U was bad, and I think a lot of the safe Mario stuff made sense because of that. But like, now that the Switch is stable and such a mainstay, it feels like they're putting their attention towards new games. I feel like old games on the Switch could use some work.
Yeah.
We never got any updates for the Mario Party games that really mattered, and that's sad as someone who is a defender of Super Mario Party and a lover of Superstars.
Yeah, and a fighter of Mario Party 3.
I love Mario Party 3.
Exactly.
I'll fight in it, though.
Yeah, you're going to fight in it.
Mario Party 3, it's on Nintendo Switch Online. I do think that the online is great. Like,
yes.
I think now it's great. I definitely get the feeling that, like, when it first came out, it was just like, do you want to play Smash on Mario Kart Online?
Yeah, it was, do you want to play Smash or Mario Kart Online? And then after that, it was, hey, do you want to play more Animal Crossing for a month and then never play it again?
The decision to include DLC in it is very nice.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, especially with the booster pass for Mario Kart.
I would very genuinely say I think it in some part carries it.
Yeah.
But honestly, like you said, I think that the online now is worth it. I will also say, though, like, it's worth it if you can get a family plan with at least one other person. Like,
yeah.
I think that $40 is a hard maximum, and I would even try and get one other person on that family plan, just because, like, you know, something that's, you know, $30 to $20 for a year of it is honestly pretty decent for what you get out of it. And I mean, I like a lot of the old games that they've been putting on. I like that they've continued to support it still, even if they've kind of laxed a bit. Like, I want them to keep supporting it. I want them to get not just GoldenEye, but like, I would love it if they could get more rare stuff. Oh yeah. My god, get more rare stuff.
Perfect
I know,
Dark, Conker. Diddy Kong Racing.
Yes.
That's like a... They gotta get that one.
Banjo-Tooie?
Aren't they getting Banjo-Tooie?
They probably are, actually, now that I say about it.
It'd anyway. Be fun if they had the Xbox version of Stop and Swap.
Yeah.
Where it's just tied to a save file. But back to Mario Wonder. We got a little off track.
Yes. Yeah. Nintendo's doing pretty decent right now. I'll still never forgive them for fucking Mario Golf not being particularly good. I was hyped for that game, and I was disappointed. Anyway, Mario Wonder is really good.
You can turn into an elephant.
Yep.
So the next thing, though, is that I like the badge system. I think that's really fun. Badges were a thing in the RPGs, obviously, but they were never really used in the mainline games. I like it as, like having an alternative moveset or, like, customizability like that is just really nice in a platformer.
Yep.
Bring back Impossible Layer. Impossible Layer had tonics, some of which were just visual, but a lot of them had gameplay elements.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is in a lot of ways based off of Impossible Layer. Also because they have a swimming badge, which is kind of works the same way as swimming in Impossible Layer, where you, like, spin underwater.
Yeah.
It's not, like, a default moveset, but it is a nice option because, you know, if you know you're going into a water level, just equip the spinning swimming badge. Hard to say.
You gotta keep that all in now.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If I had one criticism, it would just be that the first badge you get is probably generally the most useful.
It's very good. The parachute cap.
The parachute cap. Also, I'm upset that they have uncanonized Toad's head. Or Toad's hat, rather.
They did?
Yeah, I'm fairly certain that the mushroom is now just Toad's head. Like, they should have done the thing where, like, he uses that as the cap.
Well, the princesses create a hat instead of using their crowns.
Yeah.
And we all know if Peach takes off her crown, she turns into a Toad.
True.
So, like, that makes sense. But Daisy?
Yeah, Daisy? Honestly, It's like the minorest nitpick, but I'm like, okay, come on. I feel like he could have done something a little more fun with that.
What if they had, like, umbrellas?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Peach uses umbrellas.
Classic umbrella, or just kind of like doing the Peach float, maybe.
Yeah.
You know? That would have been fun. But again, that's the minor nitpick. Like, the game itself as a game is wonderful. Daisy being playable is wonderful.
That's great. The new power-ups are good. The drill mushroom is kind of similar to the one from Galaxy, but much smoother, so that's good. The elephant exists, and then the bubble flower is really fun.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that if you capture something, you can bounce on the bubble, which has screwed me over in levels. Because here's the thing. Okay, so I think the thing I respect the most about this game is that it has interesting variety in ways that Nintendo doesn't always provide. There are breather levels, or like break levels, which are easier than normal platforming levels. Oftentimes they don't have a Wonder Flower, but they instead have some sort of gimmick. Like, there are puzzle levels where you have to sort of look for clues in the environment.
Yeah.
There's one that is entirely invisible blocks, so it's like building the level as you go.
Yeah.
There's one that was like legit a getting over it level where there's no death. It's just like platforming that's annoying and you fall down when you miss.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Those are all things that are big in the Mario Maker community.
Ah.
And then also the special road level, or like there is a Star World spoiler, and the Star World levels are actually genuinely pretty hard, in my opinion, especially for Mario. And it feels like they're taking inspiration from Mario Maker, or at least from ways that the community has sort of reinterpreted the mechanics of Mario. Because, like, getting over it levels were sort of a big fad in Mario Maker. Maybe not even a fad, like, I still see people play them and make them. Where, like, it's not, there's no death, it's just time waste in, like, annoying platforming rather than strictly difficult platforming or precision.
Yeah.
And I think, like, Nintendo has long had a pretty hard stance on what is and isn't a Mario level. And there's sort of been very, I don't want to say casual focused in a negative way, but more so just, like, they have a pretty hard cap on what difficulty things can be.
Yeah.
Or, like, just what the flow and the structure of a level is. You know, platforming's at the focus, so they gotta have, you know, a lot of jumps and stuff. But, like, they're not afraid to mix it up in this one, which is really nice.
Yeah.
There's some elements of that in previous games, like 3D Land and 3D World had like the optical illusion levels and the Captain Toad levels, but this feels like they're really trying to make that a core part of Mario rather than like a guest appearance or a way to use a gimmick on the console.
Yeah. Yeah, Nintendo is like, Nintendo has been I can't make this claim, but I'm going to anyway. Nintendo feels like one of the few companies that still really has core design Bibles. Like, you know, like, Miyamoto has a Bible of, like, this is what a Mario game is, this is what a Mario game needs, and you cannot stray from this too much, or else it's not Mario. And, like, it seems like Wonder has been an attempt to really branch out from that and really, like, try to capture a new era of Mario. And God, I'm here for it.
It, to me, I think it's a mix of, A, they are the Disney of game companies.
Yes.
They have a brand to protect, and that brand is very intentional. So they try not to stay outside the brand too much. And B, like, they have had, literally the guy who made Mario still works at the company in sort of a, as an advisor role now, but for a long time he was in a sort of managerial position, yeah, creatively.
Like, he was still a director on these games. He either directed, taking part.
Yeah, he either directed or he, like, mentored the people who directed. So it's easy to see how they could become kind of stagnant and homogenized by virtue of the main influence being kind of the same person or led by the same person.
Yeah.
So it's just having outside eyes on the project with a little bit more freedom helps.
Yeah.
I think. I hope Nintendo gets a little more lax in some of their other games, though.
Yeah, I fingers crossed. We're not going to talk about it much, but the Thousand Year Door remake is also coming out sooner rather than later, and oh my god, I'm so fucking hyped for it, and I really, really hope that, like, I really hope that it sells well, that it is a good game, and that it, like, really kind of shows them, you know, going out and going back to, you know, branching out and having these strange non-standard games is good and fun and profitable. Yeah. Nintendo, hit us up if you want to do a podcast episode. We'll talk about Sonic.
We'll talk about Sonic Frontiers.
Yeah. Masahiro Sakurai, if you're listening to this, and I know you are.
Sakurai, if you're listening, come talk to us about Rivals of Aether, please.
Oh my god, yes.
Please.
Yes. And Dan Farnese, if you ever want to talk about Smash Brothers, also hit us up. So, yeah.
I feel like Dan has, there's got to be another game he would be more willing to talk about. Like, I feel like we got to talk about, like, Burnout Paradise with him. Nothing other than a soul read.
Hell yeah. Oh my goodness.
Anyways, that aside, another video game topic. We have a few video, we have a mostly video game topics.
Yeah. Oh, wait, hang on. Ring, 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 ring. Oh, let me just pick this up here. Oh, yep. Oh, sorry. I just had to take a call on my garlic phone because I think we're going to go to.
Well, it's not garlic phone. You've led the listeners astray.
Well, yeah, but it sounds like garlic phone. And so it's like a, you know, it's a crossword.
We're not talking about Gardic. Okay, so I play a lot of Survivors games, which is to say things like Vampire Survivors. There's not really a good name for the genre. I call them Survivor games, but that sounds like the show Survivor, or it sounds too close to survival games, which are completely different. I know Vinny of Vine Sauce, the guy famous for being on the news twice, calls them garlic likes because of the garlic item from Vampire Survivors that has become kind of synonymous with the genre. Very iconic. But there's still a lot coming out. I think there's less eyeballs on the genre nowadays because, I mean, Vampire Survivors is still well known, but I think it had that initial wave of hype already gone.
Yeah.
And then there was the wave of people trying to improve on it, with things like 20 Minutes Till Dawn or Brotato. But then those are now kind of old hat. The current hotness is, like, I don't know, fucking Kong Skull Island.
Extraction shooters.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just like current games, rather, that people talk about in the zeitgeist. But I still play a lot of these in the genre, and they're still coming out with them. Two I wanted to talk about, though. One is Goobies. Goobies is kind of what I wish Brotato was. Brotato is fine, but, like, it has a lot of little, like, I don't know, annoyances that pile up. Like, it has a ton of tiny numbers, and I hate tiny numbers in games. When I get, like, a +1% damage increase, I'm like, is this better than a 0.02 increase in shield? It's that type of thing.
Yeah.
Same reason I stopped playing Gunfire Reborn. It's when I have to compare these numbers that feel like such like pennies to the dollar, it feels like such a hassle, you know? And then I lose and I'm like, okay, was that micro issues, macro issues, or did I read the numbers wrong? A math-cro issue.
Math-cro. I think that's that one ARG that Adam Butcher did.
Yeah. But Goobies, like, I like the theming of Brotato. It's just kind of weird and nothing, and blobule and random, but I like random. I mean, I famously played Kingdom of Loathing once, not famously at all. I used to play Kingdom of Loathing. I like Gungeon, Maple Story, stuff like that. Goobies is great because it is in a lot of ways random, but I think it's also just pretty well balanced. It kind of has the Risk of Rain 2 thing where everything procs everything. So like, you know, you have a basic attack and then you have like the missile launcher. That's like when you hit an attack, you have a chance to fire a missile. And then you have the thing that's like when you hit an attack, it has a chance to split into three small bombs. But then like your basic attack can proc either of those and then either of those can proc the other. And so you end up with a ton of projectiles on screen, which is honestly one of the best feelings in these types of games, is the visual power creep, or just visual creep. When like when it looks like a bunch of fireworks going off, that is when my brain activates and I go hee hee.
Neuron activation.
Yeah. So like I love that when that happens. That's also a big part of why I enjoy Risk of Rain 2. And Goobies just does a really good job at that while also being pretty easy to read, pretty straightforward visually, an enjoyable one. It is kind of like, I don't know, it's like if you tried to make a game where the main character's name was literally like Scrimblow Blimblow. So I think that turns a lot of people off and makes it feel a little too memey, but it's not like Meme Run, you know? It's not like Meat Boy where they just say Forever Alone and they show the Forever Alone face. It's got its own sort of personality to it.
Yeah.
So that one's fun. The enemies are kind of basic, though. I feel like it could use some more variety there, but otherwise it's good.
I would like to interject here with an anti-hype corner here.
Ooh, uh-oh. Is it about the Deep Rock Galactic one?
It sure fucking is.
I knew it.
Yeah, this is a very brief thing. So Deep Rock Galactic is a phenomenal game. You should play it, buy all the DLCs, support the devs. They're wonderful. I love them. One of the best video games ever made. Literally my 16th favorite video game ever made. They're making a Survivors-like. They don't need to. I'm not hyped for it because I keep looking at it and going, why? Like, you don't need a specific reason. And like, I don't think they're specifically just following trends or anything. I'm willing to bet they really want to make this game. And I mean, you know, it's Deep Rock. Like, Deep Rock itself is a game they've been working on for literally years. I'm sure they want to work on something else. But it just... Deep Rock is just something that, without getting too far into it, I don't think translates well into a Survivor's life.
Yeah.
There needs to be a lot more of the, like, the variety of enemies, the variety of things you can pick up, the variety of characters there are is kind of limited in Deep Rock. Like, even if you have maybe different characters or different loadouts or something, it's still, like, you're only really picking between the four core ones. And it's something where I don't think you can really make it without kind of expanding on Deep Rock itself, like Deep Rock as a quote-unquote brand. And I don't know. I don't think Deep Rock as a quote-unquote brand needs this particular game. I will maybe pick it up on sale. Like, I'm willing to bet it'll be a perfectly fun game. And, like, I still very much like these devs, want to support them. I have opinions over Deep Rock, but pretty much all of them are positive.
I've played the Deep Rock. I played the demo for the Deep Rock Survivors, and I think the aspect of mining out the level works really well for a survivor type game. I think that's good.
Fair.
However, I didn't really enjoy it because, like you said, it feels like the property doesn't really mesh with the survivors, like, ecosystem. Like, the weaponry and attacks all felt kind of boring and bland. It didn't feel like there was either variety or scale or, like, stuff like that, or quantity.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, Deep Rock is more of a game where you have very hard limits because it's both cooperative and about like risk reward.
Yeah.
As far as how far down you can actually mine.
There's definitely an aspect of like pushing too far ahead versus, you know, being able to secure an area to some extent. And or like always having the looming threat of a wave coming at you in any right. area.
But like, it's not an Omni-God mega fucker game.
Yeah.
Where your goal is to become the big power man.
Yeah.
And honestly, I feel like while there's games that definitely aren't about being the big power man that kind of work as survivor games, I think you kind of need an element of that to make it meaningful, you know?
Yeah. It's, again, without getting too deep into my specific opinions, some of my least favorite missions of the game are the ones where you're like, where, you know, your job is kill the big guy, because the game itself is just slightly not suited for it.
Mm-hmm. But like, with that being said, it's also just that I felt like, I don't know, like the weapons weren't that interesting. It just felt like there wasn't enough to really grab me. Because I feel like with survivor games, the reason you don't see many where you are weak and you stay weak is because, like, that kind of requires other systems. Like, being weak in a game while still being interesting often relies on, like, resource management or tension. Things like, you know, Resident Evil or most survival horror games. You are weak in that you don't have many ways to deal damage to a necessary degree, and you are frail. Or you have something like a bullet hell where you die in one hit, but you have a lot of survivability, and the game is about that. But, like, most survival games don't really go, or most survivor games don't really go into full bullet hell territory. Like, a lot of them don't even show your hitbox, but then, like, you're kind of expected to soak up damage, oftentimes, due to the sheer number of enemies. And so, like, the game becomes about the progression of, you start off pretty weak, but by the time the run is done, you're super strong. And maybe you need strategy and, like, some reflexes to defend against that. But there's almost always a point where it stops becoming basic bitch mode, you know?
Yeah.
I think, like, Nordic Ashes is one that I've played quite a bit. And that one has a much later point where you do that, and you have to work a lot harder. But it still has that point where you become really powerful and do a bunch of things. It's just, like, the route to that takes more work. Whereas it felt like with Deep Rock Survivors, when I played the demo, at the time there wasn't really an endpoint that felt satisfying. Like, the further I leveled up, it felt like there wasn't going to be a carrot at the end of the stick. Which is dumb, because it sounds like I'm just saying I want big monkey brain flashy lights. But, like, yeah, that's kind of the appeal of the genre to me.
Yeah.
In, like, even if I'm thinking about what I'm doing in, like, build order or kiting or whatever, like, it still doesn't really mean anything when I can play, like, Diablo 2 and do that same thing, but with more flashy lights.
My favorite part of Vampire Survivors Core is when I stop having to walk around the enemies and I can start walking towards the enemies. Yeah,
exactly.
Like, when I stop surviving and I start farming,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. So, going to Pathfinder Galaspire Survivors, it's wild that it exists because it's Pathfinder, and, like, I don't know what they're doing with their games. Like, obviously I know they're tabletop games, but, like, I guess they have CRPGs? But then they have this, a Survivors game, which feels kind of like a trend chasing sort of thing, but it's so late in the genre that they've missed the boat, if that's the case. Biggest problem with the game right now is that there is not a good dead zone for the control stick. I have a control stick that is very sensitive in one direction, which is down right, where, like, if my thumb is resting on it, oftentimes it'll end up moving down right, but if I take my thumb off, sometimes it sticks and it goes that way. The thing is, this is only a problem in, like, two games. This one, in another Survivor game where I asked the dev, hey, could you put in a dead zone? And they were like, yeah, sure. And then it works perfectly.
Nice.
Vampire Survivors, 20 Minutes Till Dawn, Brotato, Goobies, Barbarian, yet another zombie survival game. Hold on, Nordic Ashes, Soulstone Survivors. I'm going through my Garlic Zone collection on Steam of all my garlic games. Bioprototype, Bone Razor Minions, Crafty Survivors, which is the best one, Halls of Torment, Rogue Genasia, Spirit Hunters Infinite Horde, and Hollow Survivors do not have this problem. Or Holocure, sorry.
Yeah, get fucked, Pathfinder.
So, like, please just add, like, a tiny dead zone so that I don't run into enemies.
Add an option, please.
I think the progression of it is very low. Even in a game like Rogue Legacy, where it's kind of obvious that you have to, you know, grind to progress, I still like having the illusion that I'm losing because it's my fault. I think once I get, there's like a weird valley where, like, if I know I have to grind, fine. I can compartmentalize that. That is now an objective. That's like what incremental games are. If I know it's entirely skill, then sure, I can just work at it and try out new things, try to improve my skill. But the closer those two get, much like Red Dragon Inn, in the middle, there's the point where you are not sure if you have to grind or if you are bad. And that's the worst feeling.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it feels like either you're putting in effort that's not worth it, or you're putting in too much effort. Like you're either putting in too much effort or you're not putting in enough, which makes you kind of, at least it makes me self-critical. But then also it feels disappointing when it's like, I thought I could do that and I was just bad, but now I've leveled up and the challenge is gone? You know, there's a middle ground that's very hard to reach, but it feels like Pathfinder Galaspire Survivors is a little too on the grind for objectives end. But even then, I'm not sure if that is what I need to do. It's like 60% of the way through. You know, it's not 50% in the middle awful mode, but it's not completely I have to grind and that's the only way to progress.
It's still in maybe the valley, it is. Though.
Yeah, maybe I have to grind and that's the only way to progress, but it's not clear. Whereas I think a lot of times it is a little clear. As far as like the gameplay itself goes, other than that, though, there's three characters. There's like a stat system where you have the six main stats and they all do something different. I think that's really fun. I like the idea of trying out different stat combinations. It doesn't really give a exact numeric bonus. It just says what the stats do, but not how much they benefit you. I'm sure there's like a wiki somewhere where you can like remove a point, then start a run and then look at your stats and then see what they are and then, you know, move the point around, start another run.
You could
spade it, I'm sure.
I'm gonna slightly criticize that. There are games where wikis make sense. I do not think a Survivor's Like is one.
Unless it's, like, really complicated.
Yeah.
Like, I think Vampire Survivors has enough, like, secrets and stuff that they don't outright tell you that it makes sense.
Yeah. Like,
But just, like, what stats do, I feel like should be upfront, you know?
Yeah.
Now, that being said, though, there's all the other progression stuff makes sense and I think is explained well. There's a few different types of progression, and it feels like generally there's something I can improve each time I die, so it doesn't feel like I do a run and I can't even get anything out of it. The characters are fairly unique. They all have, like, passives that you slowly unlock, and those make the character more unique. They just have a fighter, rogue, and wizard, I believe.
The classic three.
The classic, yeah. The warrior, the rogue, and the magic man.
Yep.
And there's this really fun thing I've noticed where the kind of accepted standard heuristic, maybe not heuristic, but the standard of this is that magic means low cooldown. It started with the second character in Vampire Survivors, who I don't remember her name, but she has the wand that levels up with the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, no, actually, sorry. She gains extra experience, which is the thing I meant to say. Because, like, the wizard in Galaspire Survivors, one of their passives is just extra experience gain. Yeah. They do have low cooldown, which the book that fuses with the wand does. So that kind of makes sense. But I've noticed this in a few games where, like, the magic character, the wizard character, has a higher XP gain rate.
Intelligence has often been correlated with, like, higher XP or more skills in games that I have played personally.
Yeah, especially, like, incremental games and things like that.
Yeah.
I feel like intelligence, the trade-off is often you are worse, but you grow better. Much like a gifted kid.
Much like in real life.
Yeah. So that's kind of fun. I like noticing sort of design trends or standards when they appear. Kind of like how locks are green in pinball. Locks are green.
Locks are green in pinball.
If there's a green, it's probably a lock. Otherwise, the game is fine. I think it's really hard to kite a lot of the time, especially because you choose a character to play as, and then you choose another character to be like your follower. but it's hard enough to kite all the bullshit on screen with one character, so like introducing a second one just means they're probably gonna die. I think the one thing though is I wish there were more characters, just because the okay, Pathfinder and D&D, Pathfinder started as a spinoff of 3.5 by people who were mad about 4th edition, and they were like, we're gonna make our own 3.5. And then they did, and Pathfinder 1st edition kind of became this whole, like, it was popular because it wasn't D&D 4th edition, but then 5th edition came around and that was big. And I feel like the main appeal of Pathfinder 1st edition now is that it is a crunchy game for, like, assholes who want to build a wacky character. It is the build game. If you like builds, you'll like Pathfinder.
Oh, God.
If you're, like, a theory crafter who likes to, you know, find weird interactions or min-max, if you're, like, a real Johnny Jenny type, then you'll probably like, you'll like some aspects of 1st edition. However, one of my favorite things is the sheer amount of classes in 1st edition. Because you have the main classes, as seen in also D&D. You have, like, a few side classes they've added over time, like Alchemist, Inquisitor, Pirate, or I think, like, Swashbuckler, Oracle, Witch. And then you have hybrid classes, which are combinations of the other classes. So, like, you have War Priest, which is Cleric and Fighter. Or there's, like, a Shaman, I think, which is, like, Sorcerer Barbarian or something along those lines.
Sounds about right.
Like, I love the hybrid classes as a concept alone, just because, like, I love mixing and fusing things.
Yeah.
That's why Pokemon Infinite Fusions is so good. I mean, there's other reasons, but, like, that's just fun. And looking at it from a RPG perspective of, like, hey, we have these classes. What if we just, like, mix them around a bit?
And that's not even getting into prestige classes.
Yeah, prestige classes or alternate classes, which change certain aspects of the class. And then there's psionic classes and other occult classes they added in the occult book.
There was the martial classes that they added and all the, like, martial features and stuff.
And then you have Summoner, which is busted in one of the most busted classes in an RPG. Which sounds dumb,
so much.
But, like, read into Pathfinder Summoner. It's hilarious.
I miss the Eidolon so much.
Eidolon misses you.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is they have such a litany of classes, and I feel like maybe it's too much expecting a survivor game to have a ton of characters, especially one that is sort of maybe not visually polished, but they at least try to really expand upon their three characters and make them individually deep. But, like, man, this is a property that is so, so deserving of it.
It's something where I could understand not pulling from 1E when 2E is out. I can understand that. You don't want, like, you know, your current 2E property to be sidelined by people being like, look at these cool classes from 1E that aren't out yet.
But they don't have Cleric.
Yeah, they don't have, like, the fact that there are exactly three.
They don't have Druid.
And, yeah,
or
and
Bard.
There is nothing. Alchemist. Alchemist is one of the biggest.
Alchemist.
One of the biggest, like, interesting things is that Alchemist is a base class in Pathfinder 2E. And, like, you know, Alchemist has historically been essentially relegated to, we'll get to it when we get to it.
Yeah, much like Artificer in 5th edition.
Yeah. And so it's like, you know, just when you have a lot of interesting classes, even in 2E. I'm not sitting here gonna say, you know, give me the world, but having only three, having only the core three, even if you're going to, you know, make a lot of the effort on, like, customizing each individual one, that feels a bit raw.
I could understand it if they said, it's early access, we're gonna get there when we get there. They don't really have a roadmap from what I understand. The worst thing, though, is that the options are dog shit.
Yeah.
They have, like, a graphical option. They have some audio settings. No control settings.
Oh.
There's no control settings, which would be kind of nice if I could set, like, I don't know, a dead zone, perhaps?
Hey, this is a little tip from you, the listener, to me, Galen. Rather, that's to you, the listener, from me, Galen. Hat in Time literally got knocked off from my fifth favorite game to my sixth favorite game because when I was trying to play it with mouse and keyboard, because it was the only option I had, I learned very quickly that there was literally no control options, and I was so fucking angry about it that I knocked it off of my top five. Not having control options in the year of our Lord 2023 even if it is at, like, unless you are a solo dev who has, like, no fucking money, like, that is inexcusable. Please. I do not care who you, I do not care if you're, like, just a tiny small company. Have rebind controls at the very least.
Please, Steam controller settings isn't enough.
Yeah.
They can't settle everything.
Ugh.
So yeah, that's, it's okay. I'm interested to see where it goes. It has a lot of flaws, though, more than Goobies. Goobies is fine.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Goobies...
What does that mean? Please enlighten me.
I'd like to talk about something that rhymes with Goobies.
Mm.
Spoobies. Just gonna let that pregnant pause stay for a second.
Pregnant pause.
So, Lunacid by Kira LLC has released pretty recently.
Do not get it confused with Lunistus. Worst mistake of my life.
Yeah, Lunacid is the newest game from creator Akuma Kira. It's not solely them, of course, but they're the primary developer here. It is a tribute to and heavily inspired by Kingsfield and other early FromSoft games. It's a really good game from what I hear. I haven't played it. I really want to. But the fact that it has released has given me an opportunity to talk about Akuma Kira.
Yay!
Akuma Kira is probably one of my most, like, one of my favorite developers, indie developers in the indie game space. You probably know them from Spooky's Jump Scare Mansion, formerly Spooky's House of Jump Scares, until they got a cease and desist from Spooky House Publishing and had to change it to Spooky's Jump Scare Mansion, which is objectively a worse name.
I didn't know that. That sucks.
Yeah, that's why in the original version, the logo has, like, wood nailed over it, and it has, you know, Jump Scare Mansion written there. It's really funny. But yeah, I wanted to talk about Spooky's Jump Scare Mansion because a friend of mine has been going through it with me, kind of being backseat gaming and fun fact fella. Spooky's Jump Scare Mansion was pretty popular, does the rounds every now and again on the internet, your horror content creators, your Mark's Applier,
yeah.
Your Jack's Septic Eye.
It was sort of a React-tuber game because the bit is still genius to me. That it has a lot of harmless jump scares of,
yep,
like, literal cardboard cutouts popping out of the wall.
Yep.
And they're all cute. And then something fucked up happens.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's very unassuming. And then it does a rug pull.
Yeah. The other ball drops.
The shoe.
As it were. Yeah. The other shoe balls. And you end up actually running from various spooky creatures. But the cardboard, of which there is exactly one spooky-looking cardboard, and the rest of them are all just cute little, like, an ice cream or an octopus. Like you said, the joke is kind of brilliant. I believe this was made because... I don't know how 100% true this is. I believe that Spookies was made because Akuma Kira was watching a Let's Play of Nightmare Creatures and got increasingly upset at all of the random jump scares that the game threw at you. And so the cardboard jump scares never go away, and it's so brilliant because you'll be running from fucking Bab, the Silent Hill monster, and then suddenly there's a cardboard ice cream cone, and you jump. Like, you straight up go, "Ah, fuck,"
mm-hmm.
because you're already, like, you know, really tense and running away from something.
They also get in the way.
Yep, they do actively get in the way as well, which is fun. The game has 13 specimens. I'm not going to list them out here. All of them take inspiration from various horror properties or horror games. The first guide, for instance, Specimen 1, is directly a... No, Specimen 2, actually. Specimen 1 is the cardboard. Specimen 2 is actually a reference to and inspired by the Lub Glub from Adventure Time. You also have, like...
Adventure Time?
Yeah, Adventure Time. Come on, grab your friends.
Oh, I for some reason, I thought you meant Another World... In, like, the weird ape thing that chases you in that game?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, there's also, like, Ringu, who's a reference to The Ring. She looks like the Ring Girl. She has, like, VHS static over her. It's really cool. There's the Deer God, who is both inspired by, like, the Wendigo from Native American culture and the Beast from Over the Garden Wall. Really fucking good.
God.
Deer God.
I love in one of the later, like... games or episodes or chapters, there is a Weeping Angel clown.
Oh, yep. That's from the is that the Karamari Hospital?
That's
the dollhouse.
Yeah, it's in the dollhouse.
Yeah.
It's like a clown that acts like a Weeping Angel where it only moves if you don't look.
Yep.
It's great.
Speaking of Weeping Angels, probably one of the most famous ones is Ben the Merchant, who is a direct reference to Ben Drowned, of course.
Mm-hmm. And met with a terrible fate.
He's a big puppet guy who looks like the Happy Mask salesman. And he pokes out your eyes. It's gross.
Great.
But yeah, he is also the Weeping Angel, or the Peanuts from SCP.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is a really, really interesting game. It's also really interesting that, like, a big part of what makes the game work is that most of the rooms are randomly assigned, but a lot of them repeat. And that sounds like it might get grating until some of the, like, some of the specimens end up fucking with this in certain ways.
Yeah.
Where, like, for example, there's Bab, the Silent Hill monster, who looks kind of like a Silent Hill 2 nurse holding the big sword. She fucks with the textures and stuff. And so if you don't already know the layout, you might get hit by her. But because you're going through the same rooms over and over again and kind of, like, recognizing them and, you know, committing them to memory as you go through them, it ends up being the edge that helps you get past a lot of the specimens when you are in the big wide open room and you go, ah, I can't see the desk on the left. That means that the exit is on the left and not on the right, which is now a dead end. Stuff like that. The game itself is also just really charming. Spooky herself is wonderful.
Everyone loves Spooky. She's great.
She's so good. I love all of the notes that are just like, we told Spooky that we need more funding to contain these things, but she just laughed and flew away. And it's like, yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, the DLCs are also really interesting. They expand the lore. And while there's, at the very least, the Dollhouse really expands the lore, although the Karamari Hospital also has a lot to do with it. There's games that, like, expand the lore that I'm kind of like, eh, on. Like, Faith 2 is the example that I think of. Faith 3 really tied it together, but Faith 2 is a game that I always was kind of like, I feel like Faith 1 is such a perfect product as is that Faith 2 doesn't really help build upon. And then Faith 3 is pretty good, so, you know.
It all works out.
But the Spookies itself and the DLCs are really good, really interesting, and I think they expanded and really, like, explained the story in a fun way that, like, actually kind of comes to a really nice ending. Yeah, but I also really just want to shout out Akuma Kira because, oh my god, so many of their games are so good and so few people have heard of things that aren't Spooky's Jump Scare Mansion. You need to play Basilisk 2000.
Yeah, we streamed it.
Yeah, we streamed Basilisk 2000. It is one of the most interesting games ever created.
I forced you to finish it.
Yeah, you straight up forced me to continue it because I was so fucking scared of it, and I'm still pretty scared of it. But it is one of the most interesting things ever created. The original Basilisk is also quite good. Lunacid, like I said, has been getting rave reviews, and it just recently came out of Early Access, and there's no reason to think that it isn't still really good. Lost in Vivo. Lost in Vivo did get some circuit. I know that, like, Vinesauce played it. Lost in Vivo is also an incredibly interesting game that, like, is 100% worth your time, but it's also probably the one I have least experience with, and so I can't say much more about it, but, like, it's one of those fun games that really likes to fuck with you, and then, like, it, you know, it's one of those games that doesn't necessarily, like, it isn't out to get you, as it were, but it does use a lot of the genre conventions and the tropes and things you come to expect to fuck with you in the future and, like, you know, really keep you on edge the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Akuma Kira, one of my favorite creators, like, just so much of what they touch is gold. Obviously, they're not, like, a solely one-person project, but they have a lot of the influence on the games that they have created, and it is worth just shouting them out as a person, because, man, it's good. Man, I love their stuff.
I just want to mention, Basilisk 2000 is great. Not just is it haunting, but like a game with a fake game like IDE that you then use as part of the game is genius.
Yeah.
I still have a lot of my notes from like the item tags and map names and stuff.
Yep.
But
yep.
Also, it really plays around with the idea of like navigation. The way you actually find new places is really interesting and like complicated and really, really cool. And I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like, there's a lot of like using parts of the game that you wouldn't normally expect to then find other parts of the game.
Yeah. If you need a little more prompting, I can spoil the first one because it's not a terribly long thing. The first one is an SNES emulator horror game. By that I mean, when you open it, it comes with like a fake little desktop that you open an fake SNES file in, and you play it. It is a like in the fiction unreleased SNES game that like you end up going through save states of to actually learn the story of, which is like, I believe this was made in like just kind of a day or, you know, 1 or 2 days. That is one of the most interesting fucking ideas for any game like I have ever. I would love if somebody took that concept and like really delved back into it. We've already got things like, you know, the haunted demo disc and games that play off of that. I would love if there was, you know, something that would kind of refine that concept as well. But yeah, it's Basilisk 2000. Play it. It's $2. You have $2. I have $2. Like it's so good. Please play it. You should also check out pretty much every other Akuma Kira game. At least anything that is on Steam will probably do you right.
All right, something completely different.
Yep.
So I've still been playing pinball.
Oh, isn't that the thing with the green keys?
The green locks.
Oh yeah, the green locks.
Not keys. Green keys are in a different game.
Darn.
So I've definitely just been playing a ton of pinball recently. I'm in a pinball league now. I'm doing okay. I'm maybe a little above average. I'm not sure really. As far as like my favorite tables, that's changed a little bit since we did the episode. I think like my favorite right now is, I mean, Medieval Madness is up there. Godzilla's up there. Those are also the number one and two pinball table on like Pinsider.
Nice.
Those are the most popular. I really like Rush. I really like Toy Story 4. I like Godfather. The Jersey Jack Godfather is pretty good.
Yeah.
I think I've gotten really into the Hot Wheels table, which is weird because it's not that good, but I'm like weirdly addicted to it. I don't know. Help me. But I wanted to bring up a recent one called, it's the Stern Venom table, and it's really interesting. So what you need to know is that Stern has a account system where you can log in on their website, make an account, and you can track your scores tied to the account this way. It's really cool. You can, like, places can have, or arcades can have leaderboards that track all the people who log into this and their scores on the Stern games. So you could see, like, just the leaderboard in the arcade, which is really fun. I've placed on the leaderboard for a lot of machines a few times. I think on Saturday, I think I have the number one spot on Jurassic Park at the place I go to, but that's probably not going to hold for very long. Like, that's really cool. But the thing with the Venom table is that it saves your progress to an extent. So Venom is, you choose a character, you start off with four symbiote characters. There's like Eddie Brock, Peter Parker, Gwen Stacy, and who is the last one who has the suit? It's not
Carnage, I assume.
No, it's another person. It's another human. Either way, it's four different Venoms. They have a few different elements. On the regular version of the table, it's mainly just which skill shots are available and then what combos are available. On the pro version, it actually changes the layout of the table slightly.
Ooh.
There's like this banana ramp. It's like a half loop where normally you hit it, it goes up and goes around. But one of the characters, it lowers the ramp such that you go underneath it instead. Whereas that ramp doesn't exist in the premium or the pro version, the like standard edition. And it has a horseshoe, which sucks ass. It's one of the worst shots in any table. It always hits the top of the slingshot bumper and then bounces into the left drain. It's awful. The table is weird because, like, so you level up, you have a level, and you level up by doing combos and different shots, and when you get to level 10, you gain the ability to unlock a boss fight. There's one boss fight for each host, and to do the boss fight, there are three colored combos you have to shoot, where you hit one shot that's colored, and then you have, like, 10 seconds to hit the other one, or you have to start over and hit the first one again. There's a blue, yellow, and white one for every character. There's ways you can, like, spot this so you don't have to make one of them, but overall, I kind of hate these. Some of them just don't work. Like, usually when combos are in pinball tables, they're made to flow into each other, such that you do one, then immediately do the other. But some of these just don't really do that, it feels like. Or, like, if you miss once, you're boned. And so I've only been able to make the actual boss fight with Eddie Brock, who I think is, like, the easiest character by far. Now, like, the shots are weird. I don't really like them. The level system, I think it mainly gives you a few more points and you do more damage in fights. When you play in a tournament, you are not supposed to log in and use your save progress. If you log in to save your score, you're supposed to use the option that starts fresh. A lot of people don't know that, so, like, I'll go to League Night and people will, like, just automatically log in and without really paying attention, they'll keep their progress. I'm like, hey, by the way, you're not supposed to do that in the future. And it's not like I get cheated out of a ball. Like, I'm not salty about it.
Yeah.
But it is a fold that makes it a little logistically complicated.
Yeah.
Especially for very casual people who just kind of do it once a week, you know? They're not super hardcore into it. But there's not a whole lot else to do. There's, like, a few other objectives. There's Doppelganger, which sometimes appears. There's Carnage, who is like a captive ball, and if you hit it, you fight him, and then you get a multi-ball. The main thing is just the level ups and then the boss fights. Now, for one thing, if you start over, it's very hard to get to level 10 and fight a boss in one ball.
Yay.
I don't know how people do it. I had to, like, play, like, 4 times just to get to level 10, and then I had to spend a lot of time working on the shots to get the boss fight. So I guess props to the people who can do all that from level 1. But here is, I think, the thing that makes it unique, other than the level part. They've kind of fashioned it like a roguelike, is I think the actual, like, wording they've used, where you have, like, stats that you level up as you go through, and then you fight the bosses and stuff. The fact that you can save your progress means it isn't really like a roguelike, because, so, like, I've beaten one boss as Eddie Brock. If I were to log in, use my save progress, and play as Eddie Brock, I don't have to fight that boss again. It goes to the next one whenever I make the colored combos, which was interesting. I expected to have to fight the first boss again, but I guess I don't. But what is unique about it is the, like, actual mechanics of the table, the mechanisms. It has a ball tower, 2 ball towers. Whenever you make a ramp shot or any shot that goes up, or, like, the elevator shots, which, like, launch the ball up a tube, it goes into a little, like, gutter on the right side or the left side, and then it goes into a, like, vertical tower that has 2 or 3 balls in it, and it ejects the bottom ball, and then that ball goes back to your flippers. Now, what's interesting is that it ejects the ball before the first ball up top actually reaches that tower. There's a switch at the opening of the gutter that tells the tower to launch a ball, meaning that you get the ball back faster than normal.
Yeah.
It's weird, and it plays really interesting because it means that, like, you don't really have a lot of break time to, like, really plan things out. You have to very intentionally cradle the ball in order to really get any pausing time. Sometimes it means that, like, you're just going faster, and so, like, if you get a shot, the next one will happen theoretically quicker. So, like, if you hit one of the colored combos and it sends you up to that gutter, the next one is going to happen quicker, so you have theoretically more time to make the shot. Theoretically, because, like, timing on those is weird and they intentionally give you more time than it visually shows. It's a whole thing. But it is, it just plays interesting, and I think, like, it is a cool concept that makes it feel fresh, but I feel like the rest of the game just isn't interesting, like, to play. The rules are kind of basic, the strategy and the objectives are all kind of linear, so it feels less rewarding than something like Godzilla that has a lot of options, and, like, there are different choices to make, or even, like, I was pretty negative on Deadpool for a while, and I've given it another chance and found that there is some interesting stuff, especially, like, when you try to like prep for certain team ups and then you try to lock the ball for the mini Deadpool before you start a fight. Like, those are all different aspects that you then have to learn about and then combine into a solid game plan and strategy. Whereas it feels like Venom, the strategy is super plain. Like, you hit the colored combos and then you fight the boss. It doesn't feel like there's much in the way of like other objectives or separate goals. And even choosing a character doesn't feel super... Like, they're all different, but that feels like the only really meaningful choice you have in the game. And, like, the shots aren't particularly unique. And so, like, the ball return aspect feels like a gimmick just because it doesn't have a lot else backing it up. Like, I feel like if it were a more complete game with, like, interesting shots and a variety of strategies and objectives, that would make it a really cool thing. But because it feels like there's not a lot there, it feels like the ball return system, the like bowling ball system almost, it feels like that's trying to carry the weight of the table on its back. And those tables are heavy. I did want to say two more things. Jurassic Park, I've started to love. It is also kind of linear, but it has a lot of variety in the shots, as well as like, there's a lot of different sub objectives to complete within each separate mode. So it feels like there's a lot more like decision making as far as what I want to prioritize or do, which is cool. And then I also wanted to say, quick note about the last pinball time. I said it would be cool if there's a Street Fighter table. Apparently there is already one, and apparently it sucks.
Yay!
So, I don't know, make a better one this time.
Well, that's been The Cradle, the segment where Matthew Marissa talks about pinball. Oh, wait! Sudden smash in here! That's right, I would like to pitch you a pinball design. Go ahead and use my patented 1.0 to 1.5 scale of how good of a pinball design, pinball table design idea it would be. Ahem. Donkey Kong Pinball. So, hear me out here. Number one, the rails are minecarts. We got that. You can spell out banana. We got that. The
why wouldn't you spell out Kong?
I mean, you could probably
like you
spell
do
out
in the
Kong.
Donkey Kong games.
Yeah, true, true. See, I was just thinking banana because, you know, it's really iconic. But you got the Donkey Kong barrels to blast out of. You could probably have some kind of fun little mini game where the flippers become bongos to you know, Donkey Konga, etc., etc. That'd be a fun little thing. You have the option of multiple different Kongs. You have, like, if you want this to be a character thing, Lord knows you have, you know, an entire family of Kongs. And you have an entire family of gremlins, basically, and iconic villains to really grab from. You could also very easily probably slip in maybe a like Donkey Kong OG reference with like the throwing barrels down.
Yeah, I feel like you would have a shot that is like the scaffolding.
Yep.
You would probably have the animal buddies as like allies that you light through like a mystery. Like, I feel like Squawk would be the ball save.
Yes.
You know? On Guard would be, I don't know, something.
There would have to be maybe, like, a little water section that On Guard does something with. It's like the ball hold.
Maybe.
I don't know what the multi-ball would necessarily be.
Well, it could probably be one with, like, mini multi-balls, where you hit, like, a DK barrel a few times, and then you get, like, a partner.
Yeah!
And then there would be one greater multi-ball. That's like you complete an objective a few times, and then it's like the Kong family multi-ball.
Hell yeah.
You could have funky mode.
Yeah, you could have funky mode. Come on, Nintendo. Why the fuck aren't you doing this already? Why do we have to make your ideas for you?
Yeah, that's a good one. I can appreciate it.
What would you rate it?
Say like a 1.2, 1.3? Which is pretty good if you ask me. There's a lot of bad ideas.
That's fair.
I keep seeing people wanting a Lego table, which I think is really funny because Legos are famously not often spherical.
Yeah.
Like, I get it, especially because a lot of people want that to be American Pinball, who did the Hot Wheels table, and so another toy makes sense.
That's my favorite album, by the way.
American Pinball?
Yep.
It's my favorite Midwest math rock band. But yeah, I think that's a funny concept that I saw, and I was like I understand, but also this is kind of really funny.
Well, you haven't heard the pitch. The ball is a 4x4 Lego.
Oh
yeah,
so it's like air hockey.
Yep, Not at all, actually.
Pin puck.
It just kind of keeps getting stuck. Just doesn't move.
Oh no, that would suck. That'd be so bad. Yeah.
I hit it too hard and it actually got built onto the side of the stage.
That just means you won.
Yeah.
All right. So, bit of a long episode. To cap this off, quick anime recs. That's right, we're anime heads now.
Yeah.
Never thought you'd see the day, but you have seen the day.
If there's one thing that you probably have always thought about this show, it's I bet those people don't like anime or manga or anything.
So that's,
I bet they don't even like Gurugamesh.
So that's why we're talking about Handshakers. No, there's two currently ongoing anime we want to bring up. First, I want to bring up Protocol Rain, which is essentially an anime about Valorant in all but name. It is about a group of people playing a competitive first-person shooter, which is a hero shooter. However, you do play like a tactical shooter where there's low time to kill, very quiet, very slow-paced. You have thrown items, and that's a big part of it. You plant a bomb, and then you either defend it or you defuse it. You know, it's a Valorant, essentially.
Yeah, your Valorant, your CSGO.
It looks more like the spike from Valorant than the bomb from CS. Somebody mentioned that one of the maps they showed is literally just split from Valorant.
Nice.
It obviously doesn't look like it. It's great because the 2D anime part of the animation is fine. Every time it's in a video game is magical because it's like, the rattiest, it looks like Gunzy. Like, it is the rattiest ass, like, it's like they tried to make rust textures, so they took a metal texture and put black pixels all over it. That's not what rust looks like, that's asbestos.
Yeah, this game has black mold.
Yeah, so it's got mold on the walls. It looks like the ground and floor look just absolutely ugly as hell. The characters are like, they're almost all like low distance or low detail distance models, which is great. But what's great is so the like mouse movements are feel very realistic whenever it shows it from a first person perspective. But legit, whenever it goes into a third person perspective of more than one character, it looks like a damn machinima. I don't know how to put it other than like a mix of the character movements being very stilted and like not there. The lighting, just the camera positions, it looks like a machinima, and it's beautiful. Also, like, you can tell the people writing and directing it know about pro gaming. Because, like, for one thing, there's a bit where, with a bunch of scrubs, saying things like blaming the teammates or not having their keyboard or blaming monitor lag, refresh rate, which is great. There is a character who gets canceled because of things they said on a stream.
Nice!
Which is very funny.
Oh no, the bridge level.
Yeah, pretty much. And then like, but like the gameplay part has a lot of things that are very like not surface level. Like there is a character, you can see somebody do like a smoke setup where they line up their cursor with something. That character wall bangs a few times, which is like a thing not many people think about when it comes to FPSs unless you've played them before.
Yeah.
They have a whole bit where a character can hear the footstep sounds and knows the sounds different materials make. Which is, like, a super dumb high-level thing.
I love that, just because, like, it is hard to make a show about video games without kind of falling into, like, a CSI trap where the video game is just, like, this thing of people sitting down and pressing every button on a controller.
It's hard to make it feel genuine.
Yeah, but all of the, like, everything that has been described is things that real gamers do, especially like high level gamers.
It's I really hope that Young Ladies Don't Play Fighting Games gets an anime adaptation, because that's the other one that like feels very sincere in how it looks at both the community and the process of playing a game. Just a little recommendation for that one. But like, because like there's stuff about existing video games. High Score Girl is fantastic, and that's about actual Capcom games. And then there's also the manga Destroy All Humans, which is about actual magic and playing people playing magic and people using real decks that were in the meta at the time.
Yep.
But like, to make a fake game, even if it's based off an existing one, is a lot of work to make it both consistent, coherent, have like strategies and metagames that make sense to somebody who would study the rules. And then to make characters play it in a way that feels not artificial and like not like they're winking to the kids, you know? You can't be full on Steve Buscemi.
Yeah. You can't be the asshole from No Game No Life.
Well, not even that. Just, it's so easy to make it feel like, oh, you like video games, right? This is a video game. This is what a video game is like. They're playing video games. Look. And then it's just like nothing. But this feels like it has a lot of effort put into it to make it appear genuine and like realistic enough, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty great. Also, they use Discord, but it's called, actually, I think it's just called Accord, which is the opposite.
Yeah.
But like they have Discord, which is, you know, a step above a lot of other things.
Wixcord. The other anime that I believe we want to talk about here is one that we've both been watching and both liked enough that we ended up reading just the entire fucking manga, which is I'm in Love with the Villainess.
Yeah. Okay. I watch a lot of shit isekai. There's a lot related to the villainous trope, especially the villainous redemption, which is where there's a girl who is rich and is an asshole and everyone hates her. And it always starts with the premise of, I was playing this game and there's this bully character who's mean to the main character, but she gets exiled and executed. But I got isekai'd. And since this is real life and not game logic, I can change her fate. And so it's either the person reincarnated as the villainess or the person reincarnated as like a friend or lover of the villainess. In this case, it's the latter. And the thing is, like, this is not shit. This is great.
Yeah.
Because it seems to go about it from the perspective of A, actual like real life topics and like serious shit. But also like it takes a look at like a lot of these tropes and says, okay, but what if that was actually done to real people? The most obvious one, spoilers for the manga and the anime, is the villainess hates commoners. She is rich and she has been told ever since she was little that commoners are literally lesser than her in her for like all the other nobility. And as always in these stories, the heroine, the character who is like the player character in the game version of the story, is a commoner. So that alone you think would do that, but like it is such a trope for the villainess to just hate commoners with all her blood. This takes it a step further and says, okay, if that's such a common sentiment, how do the general populace react to that? And so there is an entire commoner like revolution brewing.
It's like it's not just, you know, oh, this one noble is a haughty bitch. It's like, yeah, no, if this is how this character was raised, that's probably, you know, that's a thing in the world then. And like that, you know, would make a lot of sense for it to be like, yeah, the commoners hate being the commoners and seeing nobility and, you know, just kind of being told they're just strictly better than them for no particular reason. And so like, yeah, there's an entire commoner revolution that it also plays around with a lot because a lot of the characters react to it in very different ways.
Yeah, it takes the villainess a long time to actually like gain a new perspective. She doesn't change her mind quickly at all.
Yeah, to the point where, like, without getting into too much spoilers, like, her lashing out at someone is kind of a catalyst for, like, later events that she comes to regret, that she comes to, like, look back on and be like, I think I might have caused this and I feel terrible. And so, like, by the end of the arc, she ends up, you know, really wanting to kind of actually change things, change the way that society is. And, like, help commoners have a much better life than they do. It's also really incredibly interesting that, like, in this scenario, the main character barely cares that much. Like, it's kind of a thing where the main character is like, I mean, so long as I get to be with the one who I love, I don't really care that much. Which is so interesting. But the other thing that makes this anime so interesting is, For a lot of girls love anime, we just kind of brush past a lot of issues.
So, okay, to not get too far into the weeds.
Yeah.
Yuri is a it's girls love, it is lesbian relationships. Oftentimes it doesn't directly state that those are relationships. Like, honestly, it's a miracle whenever a series does just say, we're dating now.
Yeah.
And this is because of, It's much in the same way of the West, where, like, lesbian relationships are often written for straight men to consume.
Yeah.
And this is very complicated because it is a objectifying relationship, but also it really distorts the idea of homosexuality or just, like, the idea of, you know, attraction that, like, I mean, it's exactly the same as in the West, where like men think, oh, two women kissing each other, that's hot, but I'm not going to legalize gay marriage.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's just hot that I can view this and it's two girls. But then, like, you know, anything with gay guys is, like, branded as weird.
Yeah.
See also the way people talk about Fujoshis.
Yep.
God, and so it's a huge cultural thing, but what it often leads to is series where it is essentially queer baiting girls for the sake of oftentimes male audiences. Not to say that, you know, there aren't female and non-binary and various sexualities and genders that appreciate this or watch these, but like, to be completely realistic, it is by and large for male audiences.
Yeah.
And it's a whole thing, and this does the bold move. I'll let you say it.
So there is a conversation in like episode 4, I believe.
I hold up the number 3 to try to help you out.
You held up the number 3, but you also held your like pinky and thumb in a very strange way.
What do you
way.
Want me to do? This? That
yes!
hurts. You can't see it, but I'm like, I've got like Scout's Honor, like the pinky is kind of curled up.
Yeah.
But then I was like, when I said this, I tried to like force it down, and that just hurts my heart, my hand.
Wow, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I would ask you to hurt your hand for my benefit. Anyway,
show us your best 3 with your fingers.
Yeah,
comments.
Just tweet at us, holding up your hand doing 3, and have nothing else on the tweet. So in episode 3, they have a very frank discussion in which the best friend character, who's also wonderful, literally says the line like, are you what they call a homosexual, to the main character? And the main character goes, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I only ever really was interested in women and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And what's better is the villainous, like, kind of, you know, has the panic mode of like, that's disgusting and unnatural. And like, they don't just brush past that or anything. They straight up go into details and they talk about it, where it's like, the best friend character, I think, has a point where it's like, well, you're freaking out about, you know, your instant reaction was like, you know, oh, gross, don't talk to me. But like, imagine for a minute if a man came up to you and said, don't flirt with me, you're, you know, it's too weird. Like, would that offend you? And the villainess is like, yeah, of course. And she's like, well, you more or less have kind of made the exact same conjecture by immediately assuming that because she is gay, she is going to be freaking out all over you. Like, and it is such a immediate, frank discussion. Like, it is,
and then
super base.
It goes even further, because, like, one character's like, you know, in a way, attraction doesn't really have anything to do with gender. And then the main character's like, well, I mean, I'm not into guys, and so it kind of does.
Yeah.
It's more so that it doesn't have to be straight, but, like, to different people, it can have different things, which is, like, an element of gender studies that then goes even further beyond just some people gay.
Yeah.
And, like, I think it's so cool for a series to even bring that up.
It's not just that it is cool for a series to bring it up. And it's not just that, like, it is cool for a series that is for, like, you know, like, young adults to, you know, it's a young adult to, like, adult series, I would say. The manga itself gets a little spicy in some points, but, like, it's for, you know, 18 and up.
Never read the light novel, by the way. So I don't know how to compare that.
But, like, this is leaps and bounds ahead of a lot of anime, too. Like,
yeah.
Anime specifically is usually really bad about it. Not to make broad statements, but, like, there's a lot of really shitty examples that are specific to anime. And so, like, the fact that it just comes out and has this discussion, and, again, without spoiling the manga, ends up having this discussion multiple times and talking about, like, other societal issues like this. The entire Commoner Revolution, like, definitely has kind of a socialist bent to it. Like, the fact that it is having these conversations in such a really good, really frank, and really positive way is so interesting. Like, it turns a series that was, like, you know, an interesting little spin on the isekai formula to one of the best things I've ever read.
Again, it is about taking these tropes that would be glanced over or like kid gloved and taking the gloves off and saying, like, no, here's how that would really play out. And it's so funny. It's so funny. Like, disheartening, but funny. Seeing, like, the chuds on, like, Crunchyroll yeah. comments being like, oh, this anime got woke.
Yeah.
The West got to it. And I'm like, bro, you knew you were watching an anime about lesbians.
Well, I mean, like, on one hand, like, yeah, it's like, you know, now that the series is political and woke, it's like, you're watching a fucking lesbian anime.
This was before
the
socialism. This was just when they said, I'm gay.
Yeah, yeah, I can't wait for the meltdown for the socialism part. But on the other hand, like, I will say the phrase, quote, I can't blame them, only in the sense that, not that I can't blame them for being shitheads, but like, yeah, you know what? Anime does often just kind of glance through all of these things. That's why it's so interesting that yeah. this series doesn't.
But it is so funny that they don't take a second to reflect upon themselves. Instead, they blame the beast. They're like, it's like, instead of being, huh, maybe I have been, you know, consuming media about gay people and, you know, kind of separated that from real life gay people. Instead, they go, no. Japan's been corrupted.
Yeah, it's the Starfield pronouns thing of like, I will, you know, I will play every Metal Gear Solid game and be perfectly fine, but the moment that there's a pronouns option in Starfield, the moment that there's gay people in The Last of Us, now I, quote, have to think about real life.
It's wow, cute lesbians.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like, it's like you said, it's disheartening, but at the same time, it's funny, and I really hope that some people are quietly getting woke from it. I really hope that some people are taking it to heart and really kind of like thinking about how they relate to media.
And that's not even to mention the two Polycule anime we have running this season.
Yes, yes. Great time to be Polycule. Shout out to my boy with his 100 girlfriends.
And Naoya with his two, debatably three.
His two, maybe three, probably soon to be four.
Probably not four. I really hope not.
Yeah, it shouldn't be four.
But yeah, I don't know. It's good. It's a good series. Watch it, read it. The theme for Villainous has this really fun sort of, I don't know, it's a fun theme. It's good. Also watch Frieren while you're at it. That shit made me cry on episode one. And I can't watch anymore because it's so sad.
Yep, I still need to watch it. It's gonna absolutely destroy me as well. Also, you should watch Oshinoko,
which was from earlier this year.
Yes, but is still very good,
fantastic. And I've read through that.
I need to. It gets kind of weird. So fucking good.
Also, Oshinoko, the writer of it, is the same writer as Kaguya-sama.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's a pretty fun one.
Kaguya-sama is also very good.
Also, as of Sunday, Dr. Stone is back in Jump. The manga is continuing. I can't believe it.
Basically, what we're saying is you should probably be watching anime. The anime or season right manga. Now. Or reading manga, but, you know.
Eminence is... Season 2 of Eminence is here, and that's a great series. I'm really trying to get Galen to watch it. He doesn't seem to want to.
Sorry.
Instead, we're watching Handshakers for some reason. God help me.
Handshakers?
More like Go Hands Me Off to someone else.
Handshakers, X-Arm, what's next? Shoulder Pals?
Shoulder Pals.
Well, hey.
Knees and Toes.
Hands, shoulders, knees, and toes. Well, hey, speaking of arms, I think I'm going to say farewell to arms and farewell to this podcast episode.
And I'm going to say Cat's Cradle.
I'm going to say the cat's in the cradle with the silver spoon.
Little Boy Blue and the Golden Baboon. Anyways, that means it's time for us to leave. Yeah. You can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you want to see next or things you just think we should check out. You can also mention those to us on our Twitter at NetSurferPro. Where we tweet teasers on upcoming episodes. Should have a few up pretty soon about that. And you can follow me on Twitter at Twackaroo. I post updates on when I go live on my stream, as well as pinball scores mainly. I stream on twitch.tv/twack, TWAK, where I stream most weekdays, I would say. But importantly, this November, I am raising money again for Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. It is National Diabetes Awareness Month, and it's a great charity. They do a lot of work for research and funding research and development of new treatments for type 1 diabetes, which is huge. I've talked about it on my streams there, but like the funding and efforts of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation has helped tremendously. I have a glucose monitor, a continuous glucose monitor called the Guardian sensor, which automatically checks my blood sugar. And then if it's too high above a range, it tells my pump to give me a bit of insulin. It has helped my blood sugars tremendously. That did not exist like 4 or 5 years ago.
Goodness.
Like, this is a recent thing approved by the JDRF after, you know, I mean, approved by the FDA after a, you know, long process of submission and research and development. And, like, I can't understate how much this matters and how much it helps me and people like me in similar situations. So, like, but specifically, I'm raising money by playing through Shadow the Hedgehog. And for every $50 I raise, I add another playthrough to the game. I was going to do 3 playthroughs to start off, but one of them ended up being very quick, so I guess I'll probably do 4. And, you know, if you want to see me play through one of the best, I mean worst, I mean best games ever.
One of the games of all time.
Yeah, one of the games of all time. If you want to see the Candy from a Baby cutscene, or the United States Will Never Give In to Terrorists scene, or the damn fourth Chaos Emerald scene, or really any of them, or the one where the general appears behind Shadow with a gun and he's like, I've come to kill you, Shadow.
Unfortunately, I think you've already missed, you know what they say, the more the merrier.
Well, that's a boss fight. That's not a cutscene.
Ah, yes, of course.
Yeah, if you want to see any of those great cutscenes or boss fights or levels, check those out and check out the stream and donate $50, or, you know, for every $50 I raise, you don't have to donate exactly 50. Nope. Any amount helps.
Donate $500. That's a command from me.
That's so many playthroughs. Any amount helps. And you can find me on YouTube, at Twack, and I make videos.
You sure do. Hey, as for me, you can find me on TikTok and for now on Twitter at Galen Wilson. That's at GALANWILS0N. I post my hot takes and videos on my cat sometime. You can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, and you can find me on Twitch at Machine Gun Vampire, where I might go live one of these days.
You sure will.
I sure will. More recently, I've been actually writing for videos and stuff, so if there's anything to follow, maybe follow the YouTube channel. I might actually have a video out sooner rather than later. But for right now, thank you very much for listening to Talk Surfer Show. This has been a pretty good time.
Well, like a good time to end the episode. Nande.
Nande ska?
Ara.
Ara, ara. I didn't like
the
that.
Masculine ada ada.
You know, that's a good thing. Nobody ever. Everybody's always like, you know, oh, mommy ara ara. Like, what about the daddies,
ada, ada.
Huh?
Ada ada
ada ada.
No, they say yada yada.
Yada yada.
Yada yada. My favorite Charlie Brown quote. Yada yada.
Yare yare daze. What if Charlie Brown just said, "Give me a fucking break."
Fuck.
Fuck. Let Charlie Brown say fuck. Who owns Charlie Brown? Put him in multiverses.
I think the most likely character for Peanuts to say fuck is Lucy. Yeah. Followed by Snoopy.
Yeah.
And then Sally. And then, like, probably Schroeder, and then Charlie Brown.
Yeah, yeah.
Give us your Charlie Brown character saying fuck headcanons in the comments. Let us know who you think says fuck. Oh, wait, no, I forgot. Peppermint Patty.
Oh, yep, yep.
But no, Marcy is like a step above Peppermint Patty.
Lucy has a stall that says 5 cents and I'll say fuck.
The doctor is in.
The fucker is in.
The fucker is in.
All right.